Welcome to the next edition of our monthly speaker series for the Patika Wealth Management Group. This is John Patika Jr. coming from Clearwater. And remember to subscribe on either Spotify or Apple Podcasts to listen to any of the previous calls that we've had. And the topic today that we'll be discussing is front and center on basically every media outlet, and that is the banking system here in the United States. Obviously, Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, and Signature Bank highlighted the current news cycle. And I'm also accompanied with a 2023 Forbes Best in State Advisor, John Patika Sr., who is our senior member of the group on the team, and special guest, Brad Ball. Brad, welcome to our call.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
Great. We're happy to have you. And just a little background on Brad. He has an MBA in finance from New York University and has spent nearly 30 years following the financial services companies as a sell side equity analyst. And most interestingly, he was a Fed bank regulator, and he began his career as a bank examiner for the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and got promoted to the level of senior examiner. And Brad has also been quoted by several different media outlets like the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and the New York Times. So we're really happy to have you here, and you know, we've got a lot to cover.
Brad, let's get right to it. This is John Sr. Not long ago, Brad, to get a bank run, people lined up outside the bank, got to the line, hit a line, pulled out some paper. Now a couple of clicks and the money moves fast. $10 billion a day moving here and there from different banks. And then you add an really excited media. They love this. It adds up to a serious problem. So where I thought we'd start, Brad, if you can put in layman terms, what happened?
Sure. Glad to, John. And thank you for having me on today. I'd like to make the distinction that this crisis of confidence that we're experiencing today, and I think it is still ongoing, and we can discuss that, is distinct from what happened in 07, 08. The great financial crisis was really driven by a credit event whereby really underwater mortgages and mortgage-backed securities were held on the balance sheets of virtually every financial institution across the globe, which led to a broad meltdown related to credit risk. This issue is more related to interest rate risk, and I think you could actually summarize it basically as a perfect storm driven by three factors. First, you had really bad decision-making by the management team at Silicon Valley Bank. I'll talk about that in a second. You had that happen on the back of much higher risk balance sheet exposure, both on the asset side of the balance sheet, what they were investing in, and on the liability side of the balance sheet, where they were getting their deposits from. And really a third factor, which I think we can't ignore, and that is the unprecedented tightening by the Fed that we've experienced over the last 12 months, going from a Fed funds rate of around zero to now a Fed funds rate of around 5%. That 500 basis point increase in short-term market rates, extremely disruptive. And this was arguably the collateral damage of such an aggressive Fed tightening policy. I'll just say quickly that the bad decision by Silicon Valley management, they chose in early March to restructure their balance sheet, basically take a unrealized loss in their investment portfolio and actually realize that loss. And to do that in conjunction with an attempted capital raise, which the market viewed very negatively, both equity investors and depositors saw that move as really being, frankly, stupid. The stock, the day after that announcement came out, sold off 60%. And as you alluded to, John, Silicon Valley saw $42 billion of deposits leave the bank in one day. Just by comparison, when Washington Mutual failed back in 08, they saw $17 billion of deposits leave over 2 weeks. Here for Silicon Valley, that was $42 billion, as I said, in one day. So the decision for management to restructure their balance sheet really triggered all of this, but what it revealed, as I said, was that there was a lot of risk, not just at Silicon Valley, and ultimately we saw at Signature Bank, but really across the banking system where they had been encouraged, frankly, by policy and regulatory regime since the financial crisis to add to their high-quality liquid assets, that is, treasuries and mortgage securities that don't have credit risk and therefore would not make them vulnerable to the same pressures that occurred back in 08-09, but instead incur significant interest rate risk. So it's really a duration mismatch that has led to this crisis more so than a credit mismatch, as I've indicated. And then couple that with the Fed's attempts to very aggressively pull inflation back to their targeted 2% range. And you have, like I said, a perfect storm whereby you've got bank failures. And the crisis of confidence continues because I think the market continues to question, will there be other institutions that have exposure? Are there other institutions that have a combination of unrealized losses in the asset side of their balance sheet and a high proportion of uninsured deposits on the liability side of their balance sheet? And there are, and most of the other banks, John mentioned First Republic, are not as exposed to those two metrics as Silicon Valley and Signature Bank were, but they do have a disproportionate exposure and something that makes the market relatively uncomfortable at this point.
Yeah, we'll get to some of the individual banks maybe later, but with your background as a regulator, can you talk to what the regulators did and maybe even go a little further and tell me what you think they might do?
I think it's fair to say that the local regional regulators overseeing Silicon Valley, that would be the San Francisco Fed, failed in their oversight responsibility. A bank of that size, roughly $200 billion of assets, would be subjected to either an annual or maybe every 18-month examination review, which I used to do when I started my career back 30 years ago, where they would evaluate the capital adequacy, the asset quality, the management, the earnings, the liquidity, and the market risk sensitivity, so-called CAMELS review, of banks of that size on an annual, as I said, or 18-month basis. That means that that regulator in San Francisco should have seen the extent of the interest rate risk that was on the balance sheet of Silicon Valley and should have flagged that as an area of concern, requiring management to take measures to shore up their liquidity to ensure that we wouldn't have a crisis situation. So first and foremost, I think the local regional Fed missed the boat here. Secondly, you could argue that the regulatory regime as established by the Dodd-Frank Act, which passed in 2010, was much more focused really from the beginning on the largest institutions, so-called systemically important banks, or G-SIBs, global systemically important banks, and did not put the same level of emphasis on banks that were under $700 billion in assets. As I mentioned, Silicon Valley, about $200 billion in assets, Signature Bank, a little over $100 billion of assets. So they fell below the main focus of the Dodd-Frank Act. And in 2019, the regulators, the Fed, implemented so-called tailoring rules, which went further to ease some of the cost burden of the Dodd-Frank Act on the relatively smaller to mid-size banks. You could argue that the big banks remain gold-plated, both from a capital and liquidity standpoint, but you could argue that some of the smaller banks, mid-size banks, didn't have the same gold-plating requirements, and that could have made them somewhat more vulnerable. Now, I believe that one of the key considerations here going forward will be, what is the regulatory response? I think we can talk about that, John, if you'd like to. Please. I would expect to see the gold plating applications, so things like liquidity coverage and total loss absorbing capital coverage and capital buffer requirements to extend beyond just the big banks to some of the smaller institutions. It's a question of how quickly that can be implemented and what will be the cost. But I do think that you'll see, again, some of that gold plating applied to smaller institutions going forward. Notably, the annual review that the big banks go through of their capital adequacy, the so-called CCAR, the Comprehensive Capital Analysis and Review, and the Dodd-Frank Act stress test, the DFAST, those two tests have not historically focused on stressing interest rate exposure and duration mismatches. They've been much more focused on credit because, again, that was the cause of the last crisis back in 2008. And I think those annual assessments will likely be modified as well to reflect what we now realize are significant risks in the system arising from interest rate mismatches.
Brad, can you explain, there's a credit facility for banks to draw on, and I think they draw on it, but you don't know who. Can you explain that a little bit? I'm a bit confused.
You might say when Silicon Valley and Signature failed within a few days of each other and were seized by the FDIC, what was the policy and regulatory response, and was it adequate? And I would say, well, first of all, the response was that we saw the FDIC step up and basically categorize those two banks, Silicon Valley and Signature, as systemically important. So they did that on an ad hoc basis. They have the ability to do that. They said, even though you're not considered a G-SIB already, we're going to make you a G-SIB, and thereby we're going to backstop your uninsured deposits in addition to your insured deposits. No, they didn't go so far as to say we're going to backstop all of the uninsured deposits across the banking system. They can't do that, I don't think, without congressional approval. But they can, on an ad hoc basis, declare that a bank is systemically important and therefore take that action. And I think that has helped significantly to stem the outflow of deposits and to calm some of the concerns in the marketplace. The second measure that was taken in reaction to the failure of Silicon Valley is the one you're asking about, John, and that was the Fed's decision to provide a bank term funding program, so-called BTFP, which is another backstop for bank liquidity, where the key measure of that facility was that the Fed would be willing to take a bank's investment securities as collateral at par value. Now, going back to where we started this conversation, really what happened to a lot of these banks outside of those that just failed is that they have a lot of investment securities on their balance sheet that they put on maybe a year, 2 years ago, relatively low yielding, and those investment securities go down in value as interest rates go up. And again, interest rates going up as much as 500 basis points, many of those securities were significantly underwater. What the Fed said is you can post those securities as collateral at par value, even though they could be very well significantly underwater. And what that did, basically coming from the Fed, was it said the Fed is willing to provide liquidity to the banking system, even at the expense of the Fed and ultimately the taxpayer absorbing the unrealized losses in those securities that are posted as collateral. So the combination of those two things, the FDIC action to backstop uninsured deposits and the Fed, along with the Treasury, basically offering the BTFP, was intended and I think successful to temporarily stem the crisis of confidence, to basically prevent investors, or more importantly, depositors, from running on additional banks. Again, we can talk about some of the other banks that are in focus, but there are banks out there that have relatively high unrealized losses in their investment portfolios, coupled with relatively high uninsured deposits on their liability side of the balance sheet. And those banks could be potentially vulnerable. And those are probably the banks that have been tapping that term funding facility at the Fed so far. But like you said, we don't know explicitly who's been doing that.
Well, before we start moving forward on our conversation, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the UBS Credit Suisse buyout. Now, I know you have a lot of restrictions and you don't cover European banks, so you're going to be limited on this, but I'm not. The Swiss government is all in on this with the combination of scale and of this magnitude. I mean, two big banks, they had 50,000 employees. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for UBS. I mean, we're now probably the best capitalized bank on the planet, if not number one, they're right up there. Can you say anything about the UBS Swiss buyout and the Swiss government all in on this?
Well, as you noted, I cannot speak specifically about the UBS Credit Suisse transaction, but what I could say is two things. First, and it's partially feeding off of the answer to the prior question, I think we as investors, or at least as depositors, can feel confident that policymakers, regulators are going to take whatever measures are necessary. I mean, you could argue a bazooka if it's necessary to ensure the safety and soundness of the banking system on behalf of depositors. So we saw that here in the United States with the FDIC and the Fed actions after the failure of those two banks. And we saw that internationally. I think it's publicly known that the combination of UBS and Credit Suisse was encouraged and supported by the Swiss National Bank and politicians and policymakers in Switzerland and across Europe. The second point that I would make, I think there needs to be additional consolidation in banking. Let's talk about the U.S. banking system. There's 4,300 banks in the U.S., significant excess capacity in the United States. There's a need for bank consolidation to achieve scale economies, especially in light of the fact that innovation and technology are so key to successful product and service offerings and share gains and really advancements within the banking system, the regulatory banking system, relative to what's happening outside of the banking system, sort of the non-bank emergence of financial technology companies over the last few years, I think accelerated by the pandemic, is something to think about, to be aware of, and frankly, a source of concern for policymakers and regulators where they don't have complete control outside of the banking system in an unregulated non-bank entity. And I just would say on the issue of consolidation, I believe that in my career, 30 plus years of looking at banks, we are seeing the most significant, really, distinction, delineation between the haves and the have-nots. The big banks are likely to be the beneficiaries of that gold plating that I mentioned earlier. They've been viewed as a safe haven. They've seen deposit flows that have been positive, where a lot of deposits might be leaving smaller institutions. They're going to the bigger ones. And the scale economies and the technology investments that I've talked about have already been differentiating. I think that in, again, my career, you could argue that the clearest difference between big banks and small banks is really coming to the fore. One final thing I would say about consolidation is that while I believe there needs to be more, we have excess capacity in the industry, as I said, there has been always a regulatory and political pushback against that. The sort of knee-jerk in Washington is we don't want to create any more too-big-to-fail institutions, and I get that. But at the same time, if we want the U.S. banking system to remain competitive globally and, again, to fend off the share loss to the non-banking financial services industry, then we need to allow and maybe even encourage consolidation going forward.
And to be clear, 4,300 banks, that's not branches. That is a staggering number for them to keep track of.
John, a lot of those are sort of small, $10 billion or less community banks. Frankly, I think the end game is probably some kind of a barbell, right? Where you have these big banks that I talk about on the one end of the barbell and the small community banks that have relationships and community footholds, and it's sort of a know your customer kind of relationship. I think that has a place and they'll always exist. It's the massive in between. It's the 100 to 700 billion banks in assets that, you know, I think you're going to have a hard time providing a differentiated value proposition. You know, what do they really bring to the table that you can't get from JP Morgan?
Well, let's move forward. I want to know how you think this will affect credit out there, this banking and the new regulations and people moving deposits around to the bigger banks. Tell me how you think that's going to affect it.
I think you're bound to see a further tightening in lending standards. If anyone wants to geek out on the banking industry, I would recommend to you take a look at Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan's annual letter that just got posted 2 days ago, 43-page screed, in which he talks about everything. He talks about JP Morgan, talks about the broader market, financial markets and the economy, talks about the outlook for regulation. And in that, he makes the point that while he doesn't view the crisis that we've experienced since the failure of these banks as significantly altering the strategy of JP Morgan, he does think it will likely have repercussions for some time to come on the financial markets. And in particular, I think what he's alluding to is the potential for further tightening of lending standards. So we've had already 3 straight quarters of tightening lending standards by bank senior loan officers. The Fed does a quarterly survey, so-called senior loan officer opinion survey, the SLOOS, again, the past three sluices have indicated a tightening of lending standards. Now, that has been entirely driven by the loan officers' increasing concern about the macro outlook. So banks, like all of us, are concerned about the economy. The Fed's rapidly raising interest rates. That's to, you know, tighten the demand side of the economy in order to stem inflation. What will the implications of that be for unemployment? What does that mean for the probability of a recession? And I think the banks have been basically increasing their probability of a recession for the past three quarters and tightening lending standards on that basis. But John, I think to your question, what will happen to lending standards as a result of this recent crisis? And I do think lending standards will tighten because of this as well, because you should expect two big things to happen for the banks. One is their cost of deposits will go higher. Some banks, the smaller institutions, will see some deposit runoff. The larger banks are probably going to have to pay more for deposits because deposit pricing is just more competitive because interest rates have risen like they have. The second is the banks are going to be required to, not just by regulation, but by practical business decisions, to diversify their funding sources into more long duration funding and other borrowings outside of deposits. That's going to raise their cost of funding. And the higher your funding costs, the less likely you are to lend as aggressively, right? Because you're basically funding loans with the liability side of your balance sheet, which now becomes more expensive. So the first thing you do is you try to pass on that higher funding cost through higher rates, and then you do it through tightening lending standards. So I'm not an economist. The economists are trying to project what will be the impact of this crisis and the potential for tightening financial conditions from this crisis be on the broader economy. You know, some people say it's equivalent to one or two Fed rate hikes just by having a banking crisis. And maybe, again, some are speculating that has relieved the pressure on the Fed to raise interest rates significantly further. So I'm of the view that they probably will raise rates again in May, another 25 basis points. I think the market's broader view is that they'll start cutting rates in the second half of this year. I personally think that they're going to have to hold rates higher for longer. Perhaps they won't have to raise it much above 5.25%, but keep them higher for longer in order to drive that impact on the demand side of the economy and increase unemployment and therefore slow inflation growth. For the Fed, the boogeyman is clearly high inflation. They want to fight that, and I think they'd be willing to do whatever it takes, including pushing our economy into a potential recession. So long-winded way of saying that I do think lending standards are going to tighten further. Credit growth will be slower. And while we haven't really seen a sharp yet reaction outside of bank lending in the capital markets, I would expect that capital market spreads would tighten. Basically, the availability of liquidity in the system is tightening. It's going to make it harder for people to borrow.
Brad, just a few more. In a macro sense, are banks cheap now? I know you book value, PE, all that stuff. Can you comment on that? I know there's big banks, small banks, 4,300 of them, but can you give us a big overview?
So generally, you would value a bank based on price to earnings. The earnings growth and profitability, you know, what's EPS this year and next, and what is the return on tangible common equity or ROE over the next couple of years, and use that as a basis to value a bank. But during crisis periods, when there is a potential recession looming, I think a better valuation metric is price to book value or price to tangible book value, which is book value adjusted for goodwill. The reason why PE doesn't really work in the face of a recession is that earnings, the denominator in that ratio is likely going down, and the amount of the earnings impact is as yet difficult to forecast. So, you know, it looks like in the marketplace today that PEs are very low, but they're not as low if you assume that E is going down by, you know, potentially 20 or 30%, depending on what happens to the various factors contributing to the earnings outlook. So I do think price to tangible book value is a better metric. And right now, the banks don't look as cheap on price to tangible book value. They're cheaper than they were, but not as cheap, especially relative to the overall market. And the other consideration that actually challenges even the price potential book is book value is somewhat vulnerable to the fact that you have potential pressures from unrealized losses on the asset side of bank balance sheets. So in a nutshell, the answer to your question is, while there may be an appearance that the banks are cheap here, they're not in actuality cheap, maybe a little bit inexpensive relative to the overall market. But we have a least preferred view on U.S. financials broadly, which would include banks, insurance, and diversified financials. And we have a neutral view on the banks subsector because we don't think they're as cheap as they appear.
Brad, somebody put a gun to my head and said, what couple of banks should I buy right now if I had to? What would you say?
Sticking with the theme that bigger is better, and I think more so than I've seen in a long time, my preference among the largest banks is Bank of America. I think the recent selling pressure in Bank of America has been misplaced. I think that they have among the most diversified funding bases with over $1 trillion in consumer deposits that are relatively sticky and not at risk of leaving the bank. To think about a number here, the average deposit account balance at Silicon Valley was about $4.5 million. The average deposit account balance at Bank of America is around $1 million. So a quarter of the average account balance, meaning that it is relatively less vulnerable to the kind of flight of deposits that we saw at Silicon Valley. If in fact Bank of America has been a recipient of deposit flows, as they noted a few weeks back, they saw over $15 billion of deposits come into the bank on the heels of the failure of Silicon and Signature. So Bank of America would be one that I would highlight. Another bank that is really a restructuring story, but I think also has a very stable deposit base, is Wells Fargo, ticker WFC. They're coming out of several years, so 5-6+ years of intense regulatory scrutiny because of some sales practices at their branches many years ago. They've paid the price for that. They've corrected that. They're still operating under consent orders by the regulators. But my view is that they've remediated the issues. The consent orders could potentially come off maybe in the next year or two. And like I said, they are a safe and sound bank with very strong deposit franchise. A third big bank that I would highlight is Truist, TFC. They're the combination of BB&T and SunTrust from a few years ago. It was a merger of equals. And I think Truist is well positioned because they could see the revenue synergies. They've already seen the expense synergies, but the revenue synergies of combining those two big banks, where, again, the concept is pretty simple, but it's all about execution. Can I sell BB&T products to the SunTrust clients and vice versa? And I think we will begin to see that. And they also have a very solid deposit franchise and have been, I think, unjustly sold off during this crisis period. So those are three banks that I would highlight, John: Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Truist.
Brad, in one of your reports, you mentioned office space, not a big part of the big banks. Could you comment on that one? Because office space seems to be taboo these days.
People are asking sort of where is the next shoe to drop? And I'm not sure I would characterize it as a shoe, but clearly commercial real estate is a key area of focus among investors. And in an economic downturn, I'm right, and the Fed keeps rates higher for longer, and the recession is maybe a little deeper and a little longer than is currently assumed by the marketplace, commercial real estate could be a potentially vulnerable sector. Within commercial real estate, John, to your question, office is one area of particular focus, especially sort of the B and C, lower quality office properties, the less new and refurbished sort of A-rated office properties. Just generally speaking and framing it, okay, office represents about 5% of the total loan mix across the banking system. It's much higher among the small to mid-sized banks. It's much lower among the largest banks. The top 6 or 8 globally systemic important banks only have maybe about 2% of their loans exposed to office. And generally speaking, all of the banks have been, since the financial crisis, very focused on commercial real estate and keeping relatively tight underwriting of commercial real estate. And so the office exposures there are generally higher quality. So I do think it's an area that we should watch, and it's a potential area of earnings pressure, but I don't think it's a potential area that will create a capital or solvency risk, you know, certainly not like the mortgage and mortgage-backed security crisis that we experienced 15 years ago.
Two more questions, a little short ones, and I'll take the politics out of it for you. Assuming there's a government shutdown, how about that? You don't have to comment. What effects will that have on banks? Let's just say it's a they're shut down for a while and people start getting nervous. Will that affect the banks, do you think, stocks?
Yes. I mean, as a rule of thumb, you could say that anything that impacts the domestic or global economy or financial markets could and will likely have a negative impact on the earnings growth and profitability of the biggest banks, but the contagion of such a risk could stem to smaller institutions as well. So if the Russians react badly to the fact that Finland has been added to NATO, if you have another bank failure or pressure point in Europe, if China is disruptive to global financial markets in any way, all of those things could likely have an impact on volatility and therefore negatively impact financial markets, which would then be bad for banks. And I would put a potential shutdown of the U.S. government in that category. It would create volatility. It would create uncertainty, which would be generally bad for the banking system. And particularly bad, I would say, during a period when confidence is as weak as it is currently. So we really need to get a budget passed and not go through a government shutdown. But if we did, it would be bad for the economy, for the financial markets, and for the banks.
I think that we'll have to start wrapping it up here, but maybe we can have you back in a few months to see what the government reaction to these banking problems is. And if your comments on, you know, are they going to overreact or ignore or whatever, maybe we can get you back in a couple of weeks. And Brad, that was really good.
Sure thing.
Time-wise, we're going to have to run.
Yeah, Brad, we're going to wrap up here. We're just getting pressed on time. But do you have any final thoughts before we close out our call today?
The only thing I would just leave you with is I do believe that policymakers will take whatever necessary actions to ensure the safety and soundness of the banking system on behalf of depositors. You know, that's what the Fed Bank Supervision's main role is. Again, 30 years ago when I joined the Fed, that's what they told me, that it's all about the depositor. It's not all about the equity shareholder. That's part of the reason why we're, you know, on the sidelines and broadly cautious on financials and on banks. I do think that when the dust settles around this crisis, and we do have earnings coming up, it's worth noting that a week from tomorrow, April 14th, we're going to get JP Morgan, Citigroup, PNC, some other big banks all reporting their first quarter results. And it's an opportunity for them to provide some soothing commentary about the liquidity and capital strength of their individual banks and of the industry. And I think that could calm the markets, and you actually could see somewhat of a knee-jerk bounce back after the really rapid sell-off that we've had. But then I think we're going to reconsider the outlook for earnings growth and profitability, as I discussed in the context of valuation. What's the outlook for the future of net interest margin, net interest income in this rising rate environment? What's the outlook for credit if we do, in fact, go into a recession and unemployment rises more rapidly than expected? And what's the outlook for capital, especially if the regulatory environment gets tougher? I do think capital costs are probably going to rise across the industry. Compliance costs and capital costs go higher. That means it's just a tougher environment to make a case for equity investors to own bank stocks. With that, I'd end it there.
Brad, I really appreciate you spending some time with us this morning. And that concludes our call for this month. And I hope everyone has a great Easter. And if there's anything that you need, feel free to reach out to anyone on the team and we'll be able to help you out. So with that, I appreciate it again, Brad. And everybody have a great weekend.